I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 24th, 2017. The time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Coghill is excused today out on other state business. Senator Stedman also indicated he had another commitment. I expect Senator Meyer and Senator Wilikowski shortly. Thank you so much to Chris, who's keeping records for us, and Matt, who is managing the audio. So today on our agenda, we are taking up an overview of Alaska's seafood industry. This committee is very concerned about the vibrancy and success of our coastal communities. The control of our fisheries was one of the things that pushed us to statehood. And of course, Senator Ted Stevens was instrumental in establishing Alaska's control over our fisheries. The Magnuson-Stevens Act will be 41 years old next month, and it serves a twofold purpose: a spear against foreign fleets and a shield mandating sustainably managed fisheries. Senator Stevens' vision of value-added resources was extremely important and certainly has guided the state and this industry. So we have a panel of great presenters today showing the interaction of local, state, and federal officials with private industry in sustainably managing our fisheries. So first, I'm going to welcome one of my favorite commissioners. The Commissioner of Commerce is Commissioner Laddick, Chris Laddick. If you'd come forward, Commissioner. Commissioner Laddick was a longtime city manager of a seafood city on Alaska. I was getting on a plane once. I had an Unalaska sweatshirt on, and the flight attendant said, "Dutch Harbor, it's so Unalaska." I thought, you probably have heard that a lot. I thought it was very cute. But in any case, Commissioner, you, of course, have a unique perspective, having managed a community that's a seafood community. So we're looking forward to your opening remarks. Welcome.
Okay. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak today. It's been quite a road for me in my career. As I was in Galena in 1990, a town of 500 on the Yukon, and they had a small chum facility there. And they opened briefly during the chum season, and the roe was of extreme high quality. This is in the early 90s. I was able to meet Sidney Huntington, who spent hours talking about fish and game issues, and I'm especially grateful for my time with him because he was passionate about the importance of his vision of the chum fishery on the Yukon, and also he was passionate about the conservation of Yukon kings and the importance of them to the subsistence economy. Little did I know that this was my introduction to what would be a journey of education and discovery about commercial fishing in Alaska. In 1994, I went to Dillingham as their city manager. My fisheries education took off. Bristol Bay is home to the largest red salmon fishery in the world. And the history of the commercial salmon fishing in the bay goes back to the late 1800s. It's a fascinating topic if you have time to do some research. In Dillingham, there's a rhythm to life revolving around fishing seasons. The brand and quality of the product is a source of pride for everyone in the community. And I include fishermen and processors that come from outside as part of the community as well. They all contribute. In 2001, I moved my family to Unalaska, which is the home to the international port of Dutch Harbor. That's where I got the equivalent of a master's degree in commercial fishing issues. I was aware of inshore, offshore, but I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I moved there. I learned what ground fish are and the importance of the Bering Sea to the Alaskan and United States economy, not to mention the fact that the products are delivered worldwide. The shipping infrastructure in Alaska can ensure that fish arrives on a scheduled service virtually anywhere on the globe. I also learned about the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. We have the best managed fisheries in the world, bar none. Fish stocks are managed with input from all sectors of the industry and government and rely upon sound science. The process works. One of the reasons I wanted to move to Unalaska was their great school system. They rank in the top schools in Alaska on a regular basis. And then there's the Coast Guard. They're an integral component of any fishing community in Alaska. And when a ship gets in trouble in the Bering Sea or any Alaskan waters, there's only one place to call. That's the United States Coast Guard. It's an absolute pleasure working with them over the years, and especially with Admiral Osterville on Arctic issues when I served on the Northern Waters Task Force and the Arctic Policy Commission. Seafood's a bright spot in our economy, and you will hear from others testifying today with regards to the numbers of jobs created and total value, so I won't go into it. However, the competition is fierce. There are more and more options for fish protein alternatives coming on the market every day. The one thing I've learned is that the fishing industry can turn on a dime to get things done to adapt to markets. One year, surimi is the optimal product sought by the market, and the next, it's fillets. The equipment in the plant gets taken out, and more new, efficient equipment gets installed in a matter of months. Government could never respond this fast. The fishing industry is dynamic and ever vigilant to responding to market demands, which can make it a bit of a roller coaster for them and the community in which they reside. You're also going to hear from Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and the job they do for Alaska. I'm on 20-some different boards as Commissioner of Commerce, but I'm honored to be on the ASME board working with industry members to promote the best we have to offer from Alaska. Anyone who has been to Alaska realizes that commercial fishing is not just about the boats, not just the processors. It's also about support industries, welding, trucking, cold storage, fuel and equipment, ship supply, bulk food supply. It's having capable labor 24/7. It's having everything available 24/7. And it's the contractors that build the docks, the power plants, living quarters, processing facilities that all provide jobs and hard dollars into the community. It's a symbiotic relationship between industry and the community, and each benefit. Communities have a host of responsibilities in their link in the economy. Capital projects for public facilities include docks, roads, landfills, power plants, wastewater, drinking water facilities, clinics, schools, public services, such as police, as well as fire and EMS. Often the community provides the only place for workers to go to check their email at the public library. So you may ask, how is that different from anywhere else in Alaska? It's different because there's an ebb and flow to fishing seasons that creates peaks and valleys in utility and service demand. Alaska is a community of 4,500 people. There are 32,000 airplane seats sold in the market for Alaska. AC's in Pollock starts January 20th and lasts until the end of March or middle of April. The utilities are built for this demand. The police department is staffed for this demand. The health clinic and all services are staffed appropriately to meet the demand. For instance, the water plant in Unalaska provides up to 7 million gallons a day to meet the demands of the processing plants. This utility is the fifth largest water supply in Alaska based on volume. Municipal government can never let up on planning and maintenance. No small job in Unalaska. In summary, living in rural Alaska and fishing communities has been an incredible experience for myself and family to live and work. The exposure I have gotten while working with multiple state and federal agencies has been a learning opportunity of a lifetime. While the commercial fishing industry is dynamic and has many complexities regarding the plethora of federal and state agency regulations, there is tremendous opportunity for innovation to increase the value of our seafood products. I've enjoyed learning about fish and at the same time building communities. The seafood we produce comes from an incredible renewable resource, and we manage it wisely. I'm also honored to come to know many of the players in the industry and know that every day they work to sell our brand and maintain the highest quality seafood possible. Wild, sustainable seafood to the world. It's a great story, and I'm proud to be part of that story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Committee members, first of all, welcome to Senator Meyer. Any questions for Commissioner Laddick? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So next we're going to go on to the interaction between state and federal agencies. So we're going to have Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and then the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. So first I invite Trent Hartel from ADF&G to the table. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Trent Hartel with Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Today I'm going to be going over a high-level overview of fisheries management and jurisdiction in the state of Alaska and the agencies responsible for fisheries management. So to begin, in general, there's two primary agencies, regulatory bodies in Alaska that are responsible for fisheries management. There is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the regulations that The regulations that govern these fisheries are developed through the Alaska Board of Fisheries, and the fisheries generally occur from 0 to 3 nautical miles. The other primary agency is National Marine Fisheries Service, and the regulations for these fisheries are developed through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. And these fisheries occur from 3 to 200 miles offshore. I'll also note that the state of Alaska, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has a dedicated seat on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and that's for the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. So the state, through the department, has a role in assisting in the development of regulations and fisheries management in the federal fisheries. So within these two management bodies, there's three general types of fisheries. There's a federal fishery that occurs in federal waters from 3 to 200 nautical miles offshore, and those fisheries and the regulations are guided by the council process. The harvest in these fisheries is deducted from a federal total allowable catch, or a TAC, and that's a federal term essentially meaning that that's the target amount of catch that we aim for vessels to take. Second type of fishery is a parallel fishery, and this is one that occurs inside state waters, is managed by the Department of Fish and Game with regulations and jurisdiction through the Alaska Board of Fisheries. The unique nature of this fishery is that it is the Board of Fisheries generally adopts the federal rules and regulations that occur in the adjacent federal waters into state waters, and this provides a seamless transition for the fishery participant. So there's a seamless set of rules from 0 to 200 nautical miles offshore. Despite the federal rules being adopted into state waters, it's still a state-managed fishery, and it still falls under the Alaska Board of Fisheries jurisdiction. Harvest in these fisheries is deducted from the federal total allowable catch, though. The last...
Senator Hughes had a question.
Just a real simple one. Is that total allowable catch a per vessel amount, or is it in a region, or how does it work?
In open access fisheries, vessels compete for the amount of available TAC, so there's not an individual allocation. In some fisheries, there are individual allocations, but in the example I'm providing, they're open access, so they compete with one another. The final type of fishery is a state waters or a GHL fishery, and GHL is guideline harvest level, and it's essentially analogous to a total allowable catch. This is just a state terminology that we use for a total amount of harvest that we're managing for. These fisheries, again, they're wholly within the Alaska Board of Fisheries process and only prosecuted from 0 to 3 nautical miles offshore. So just to provide you an orientation with where some of these fisheries occur in Alaska, this is a map of most of Alaska. I apologize for not including Southeast on here, but the thick black lines depict the state management boundaries, and the large colored blocks are the federal areas. So you can see that there's some areas that the state and federal areas align better than others, but in general there's pretty good agreement between where the state fisheries occur compared to the federal fisheries management boundaries. So as we move forward, the next series of slides are I'm going to use a case study or an example of how these two management bodies work together or where some of these overlaps occur. So I'll caveat the next series of slides by noting that the state has many fisheries, and there's no unique single template or example where the Board of Fish, the Department of Fish and Game, or National Marine Fisheries Service uses. The fisheries are generally geared towards the user groups, the areas, the fleets, and the target species. So one good example to illustrate how these different management bodies work together are the Pacific cod fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska. So the top of this slide shows that there's just some general terminology which I've touched on. The acceptable biological catch limit, that's kind of a bright red line that we use in the federal fisheries that we don't want to exceed. The total allowable catch is the next terminology literally on the slide below it and in practice below it. It's an amount less than the ABC. And it's what we target to catch. That's an amount that we strive to facilitate vessels to actively take. And the last one is the guideline harvest level, and that's wholly just a state of Alaska term, which is essentially analogous to the TAC. So as we walk through this example with the Central Gulf of Alaska Pacific cod fisheries, there's a total Central Gulf of Alaska ABC, and 75% of that is allocated and dedicated to the total allowable catch, or the TAC. And then of that, that is further distributed between different seasons. There's an A season and a B season, and a little bit more is dedicated to the A season compared to the B. And then within each of those, there's the Pacific cod is allocated to specific gear groups, and that's what is actually hits the water. If we move back to the big circle on the left, 25% of that is allocated to the state waters fisheries in the form of guideline harvest level. And then within that 25%, it is further distributed between the different management areas in the Central Gulf. And Cook Inlet, Kodiak, Chignik are the three state management areas. And then the different proportions of GHL then are allocated to the gear types for pot and jig in these fisheries. So the next series of slides, I'm going to kind of take these examples and apply them to the federal, the parallel, and the state waters fisheries to see how some of these this flow of total allowable catch and GHL is applied to the actual fisheries.
Okay. You might answer.
Excuse me, Senator Von Imhoff had a question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, thank you. I suspect that your subsequent slides could answer it. There's a lot of information, so I can't read it very quickly. But in this slide that you just had, does this sort of fit into here? So, like, there is an A season, a B season, a Cook Inlet, Kodiak, or are this completely separate?
They're completely separate, and I will touch on that a little bit in the next couple slides. But if you view the top half, is separate from the bottom half. So the top half is the federal and the parallel fisheries, and the bottom half is just the state waters GHL fisheries.
This is 0 and 3 miles, and this is beyond 3 miles.
Exactly.
Also, well, I don't know how big Cook Inlet is. I mean, I assume so. Do these also occur in this area, just farther off water, or is this a completely different area?
Yeah. So if you look at the figure here, the Cook Inlet area is. The figure on the screen, the Cook Inlet area is for the state management areas. Uh-huh. It's the black line, just literally in Cook Inlet. And the federal fisheries for the Central Gulf are all of that kind of pale blue section from, you know, where it says Chignik to near Prince William Sound. So the upper portions of this slide, where the TAC, the A season, the B season, that occurs in that pale blue area. When you move down into the 25% in the GHL over to Cook Inlet, the Cook Inlet portion only occurs within that thick black line in the Cook Inlet area on this map.
So the whole
follow-up?
Sorry. So the whole blue, the whole light blue is the federal part, which is the A and B season.
Correct.
But not within the Cook Inlet, not within the state area that has to go on the outside of the state boundary?
So I think the next couple slides may help answer some of those questions.
My question is that it seems to be that certain areas may get fished twice or may get fished, but maybe I'm seeing it differently because of the 3 mile rule.
Right. So the A season and the B season in the federal fishery can occur from 0 to 200 miles in the form of a federal fishery and the parallel fishery. Where the state season comes in, where the GHL season comes in, is when that fishery closes. That is the trigger that allows the GHL season to open.
Thank you.
Senator Hughes, question.
And mine's a bit related, but when you think about, first you have that 0 to 3 mile, and then you have 3 on out to 200, and yet we're seeing 75% going to the 3 to 200 mile marker. So 197 miles, where only 3 miles is getting the 25. So why is it 75% for such a large area, 25% for the 3 miles? It's just not proportional. Is there a reason? Are there more fish closer to land, or just why is it broken out that way?
Good question. When the state waters GHL fisheries were developed, there had to be a starting point for how much to allocate to a GHL fishery. And one of the metrics that informed the Board of Fish and development of these fisheries is what is the historic proportion of catch that occurs inside 3 miles. And at that time, it was about 25%. And so that was the basis for why the Board of Fisheries started with the 25% allocated to the GHL fisheries.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Well, I guess, and it must work well because you've stuck with it, I assume. Is that correct?
Yes. So, you know, again, this slide on the Central Gulf is just one example. There's many other areas of the state where we have GHL fisheries, and there are other areas that have a different percentage. And that's reflective of, you know, the historical participation in that area. And also, it's a stakeholder-driven process at the board where stakeholders are able to go and advocate and request modifications. One example is recently the Board of Fisheries increased the amount that is allocated to the fisheries in the South Alaska Peninsula area. They used to be 25%. They're now 30%. So that was a change that was driven by the user groups that requested to have an additional amount moved into the state waters fisheries. But the beginning amounts and the ongoing management is a Board of Fisheries job, essentially. It's their decision as to the amounts that are provided. The department simply implements the fisheries. They facilitate the management plan and provide the seasons accordingly, but our decisions are not made to make those types of changes.
Thank you.
All right, I'll let you go on.
All right. So the next couple slides are going to be a high-level overview of the federal fishery, a parallel fishery, and a state waters fishery. And you'll see some of the similar information, but the takeaway is some of the differences that we see in these three fisheries and the management of them. So for the federal Pacific cod fishery, again, it's 3 to 200 nautical miles offshore. The harvest limit's based on a fixed percentage of the Pacific cod ABC, and there's specific gear sectors for trawl, longline, pot, and jig gear. And there's also separate allocations for whether the operations are catcher vessels versus catcher processors. We talked about a couple different seasons, the A season, the B season. In these fisheries, there's no gear limits. However, there is a single overall vessel length limit for the Gulf at 125 feet. And the access into these fisheries are limited by a federal kind of a two-tiered approach of federal permits, a federal fisheries permit or an FFP and a license limitation permit. There's also a variety of stellar sea lion protection measures, and they're essentially no fishing zones, and they're discrete by gear type. And for compliance, there's a vessel monitoring system that all vessels that participate in these fisheries must carry. And finally, there's observer program requirements for these participants. So if we move over to the parallel Pacific cod fishery, these are the fisheries that, again, are just in the 0 to 3 nautical miles, and they're essentially a federal fishery that occurs inside state waters, and the state adopts the similar regulations. So there it's a concurrent fishery with the federal fishery, and there's a shared TAC. There's a shared there's a single overall total allowable catch for all participants, whether they're inside 3 miles or outside. Same gear and sectors that participate. However, the Board of Fisheries has provided some bottom trawl restrictions. So in the Gulf of Alaska, there's a quite a bit of state waters that are closed to bottom trawl gear. We talked about the A and the B seasons. They also apply during the parallel fishery. There's no gear limits, but the Board of Fish has developed some vessel length restrictions for certain gear types and in certain areas. One key difference, the next three bullets are a few of the key differences between the parallel and the federal fishery. In the parallel fishery, it's open access. The state of Alaska doesn't administer an FFP or an LLP program, nor does the state recognize the LLP or FFP requirements in the federal fishery. So what this essentially means is that any vessel can participate as long as they follow, you know, the other rules, such as seasons and gear types and things like that. The state also adopts most stellar sea lion protection measures, not all, but most. And the observer program requirements only apply to the federally permitted vessels. So moving along to the state waters Pacific cod fishery, again, these are only 0 to 3 nautical mile fisheries. They are developed through the Board of Fisheries process, and the harvest limits are based on a percent of the federal Pacific cod ABCs. And the seasons are opened after the federal parallel fisheries close. So this prevents overlapping fisheries going on at the same time. One of the key differences between the parallel and the federal fisheries with the state waters is the gear. In general, most of the state waters Pacific cod fisheries are open to just pot and jig gear. There's a couple exceptions. One's in Prince William Sound and Aleutian Islands, where both Prince William Sound and Aleutian Islands is open to longline gear, and the Aleutian Islands also is open to trawl gear. There's gear limitations, 60 pots, 5 jig machines, and most areas have vessel length limitations. The form of access is the GHL fisheries, the state water fisheries, do have an access provision. It's different than a permit system. The state implements an exclusivity requirement, and essentially this is a way to control vessels' participation in different registration areas in the same calendar year. So some areas have more stringent requirements, some have less requirements. There are stellar sea lion protection measures, but there's only the rookery protection measures. So the federal haul-out protection measures are not adopted in the state waters fisheries. And there's no observer program requirements for the GHL fisheries.
Senator Von Imhoff had a question.
Thank you. So going back to the parallel and the federal, how long are the seasons? I see they start January 1st and September 1st.
They're unique by area. So there's a number of factors that influence the season length. One is the size of the total allowable catch. Some areas have a higher total allowable catch than others, and the participation in these fisheries. But in general, the fisheries close in, you know, February or March.
Okay, like a
follow-up, Senator Munden?
So 30 to 60 days. And then so what would usually – I'm seeing that smaller boats will do the state waters versus bigger boats will do the parallel and or the federal. Is that how it is? I mean, how do people or fishermen select whether they do the parallel or the state?
Good question. There's a lot of overlap. Many of the vessels will participate in both the federal parallel fishery and the state waters fishery. And there's also many vessels that only participate in the state waters fishery. And so it's largely dependent upon business plan and other opportunities that vessel will have.
Okay.
All right, I'll let you continue.
So Just to summarize what we've been talking about today, there's, and again, kind of looking at this from the lens of, you know, jurisdiction in of fisheries management in Alaska, there's two management jurisdictions. There's state and federal management. There's three types of fisheries: the federal, the parallel, and the state, and they have varying levels of overlap. And each of these fisheries are I'll again reference my comments earlier about, you know, that there's not a single template or single form of fishery in Alaska. Each are unique, and they're highly dynamic across all of the areas. So I hope this was a broad overview that can help inform how the Department of Fish and Game and National Marine Fisheries Service, some of the roles and responsibilities and what some of these fisheries look like. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. It was very helpful. This is a new area for me, and maybe it sounds like it might have been for Senator Von Imhoff, too, so I appreciate it. Can you tell us how it works as far as working with those that work on the federal level, the federal employees that are dealing with this? They're located here in Alaska, I assume. And so talk a little bit about your communication and meeting and how you work together.
So as it relates to the management of these fisheries, we have a good working relationship with the in-season management staff that manage the federal fisheries. And typically what will happen is as the federal fisheries begin to wind down, as they begin to approach their total allowable catch, and our federal counterparts are considering closing that fishery, we'll be in contact with them to determine, you know, kind of what they're thinking. You know, is it a day or 2 days or another week? And at that time, they'll make an announcement to close the fishery. And then we have in regulation a time period, and it's unique for each area, when the state waters fishery will open. So we have some flexibility in the timing of these closures on the federal portion and the opening on the state portion, but you know, we have a pretty good working relationship and line of communication to know when these things are going to occur.
And we're about to hear from the regional director, regional administrator for NOAA, so that can be a question, or you can hear his presentation. Any other questions specifically for ADF&G? Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Hartle. That was very, very good.
Thank you.
And so next, I welcome Glenn Merrill. He is the Assistant Regional Administrator, NOAA Fisheries, Alaska Region.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present to you today. I will be providing you a purposely very high-level and relatively brief overview. I think you've already heard from some of the presenters today of the very collaborative working relationship that we have, the complexity of the fisheries that are involved, and the importance of fisheries to residents of Alaska. Within the federal system, many of the concerns and issues that residents of Alaska have are recognized through specific provisions in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. I'll briefly touch on some of those, briefly touch on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council process, and then provide you just a brief example of some of the ways that we work to coordinate with residents of this state as we manage the federally managed fisheries. I think there are probably three principal roles that are important for the residents of Alaska to interface with the federal government in terms of the day-to-day management of the federal fisheries, and that is through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. There's cooperative management that we have with the state of Alaska for a number of species, and I'll briefly touch on those as well. And then, of course, there's ongoing research. And throughout all of our federal process, I think one of the things that's helpful to keep in mind is that this is a very public process through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council process. Our laws and our regulations are also something where there's an extensive opportunity for the public to engage in that. And we take very seriously the importance of us engaging with the public here in Alaska so that they understand the implications and the management process that we use at a federal level. Just very briefly, for the council process, for those of you who aren't necessarily familiar with all of the nuances of fisheries, and there are a lot of complexities, as you've just seen, one of the things that's unique about the way the fisheries are managed in Alaska is through the Magnuson-Stevens Act, as you had mentioned, Madam Chair, Senator Stevens and other senators had recognized the importance of having direct involvement by the stakeholders in the policy development process that we use. And so the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is a policy development body. They recommend policies to us, the federal government, and then we're responsible for reviewing those to make sure that they're consistent with existing laws, and then we implement the regulations that result from those policies. The state of Alaska is a key voting member on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. They have 6 of the 11 voting seats on the council. As Mr. Hartel mentioned, the Commissioner of Fish and Game is one of those seats, and then there are 5 representatives that represent a variety of different interests from various communities and different fishery groups that are also active in the fisheries. The Magnuson-Stevens Act, when we develop these regulations, these policies, through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council process, requires balancing a lot of different interests. And as you have seen already, there's a lot of complexity with fisheries. Typically, if you're restricting or limiting one fishery for one set of participants, that's providing opportunities for others. Balancing those different suites of interests is complicated, and the Magnuson-Stevens Act recognizes that by requiring all of these policies to balance a range of what we call national standards. And a few of them I've just noted here on this slide. It includes trying to achieve the optimum yield from the fishery, providing for fair and equitable allocations among residents of various states, providing for sustained participation in communities, and minimizing bycatch. So that's just 4 of the 10 standards that all of our regulations have to sort of balance as they go forward. And just a brief example, if I may, of this balancing act that we use is an example for our groundfish catch. Now, groundfish, just for, so you know, refers to basically anything except for salmon, shellfish, herring, halibut. And as you can see from this slide, this just gives you a brief overview of groundfish catch in the federal fisheries off of Alaska. And unfortunately, the slide doesn't show the units, but this is in metric tons. So this is billions of pounds of fish that are being harvested on an annual basis from Alaska and have been for over a long period of time. As you can see from this slide, what we've attempted to do is ensure that as fishermen are active in these fisheries, they're actively harvesting these fish and minimizing the amount of bycatch that they take, the amount of discards that they have at sea. And we do a very good job of that when you're looking at this from a groundfish perspective. 98% of all of the groundfish that are harvested are retained. So a very limited amount of discards. And we do that through a variety of different regulations that try and balance the interests of all of these different groundfish users. It's complicated. It's not easy. It's sometimes contentious, but it's something that I think we've spent a lot of time, as you mentioned, over the last 41 years trying to figure out how to do better and better. I think a few keys, if I may, that have led to relatively successful management off of Alaska, and I think you'll hear this from other presenters that are coming, is that we have a very robust scientific and research program, and that includes science and research that we do here in Alaska, the federal government does. It's grants that the federal government provides to the state of Alaska and to other academic institutions here in the state that are active in a lot of these fisheries research. We are very, I think, linked to our science. In other words, we care very much what comes out of that scientific process. I think that's one of the hallmarks of federal fisheries off of Alaska. That's not necessarily the case in all areas in the nation, but it's certainly the case here in Alaska, where that scientific evidence and that scientific input has been really important in shaping the way that we manage our fisheries. We have really effective monitoring, accounting, and enforcement. We have the largest at-sea observer program in the nation. We have tens of thousands of days that are observed on various vessels throughout Alaska. That provides very essential information that we use in our day-to-day management of the fisheries. As Mr. Hartel has noted, we have limits on fishing capacity, we have limits on the total amount of catch that's allowed in our various fisheries, and we adhere to them. And that's something that's also one thing that I think Alaska can be particularly proud of. We're also very concerned about other issues, such as uncertainty in our management, and we try and recognize that by having precautionary and conservative management. We're concerned about understanding the impacts of habitat and protections and how that can help our species moving forward. Just a few examples of some of the things that have been helpful for us.
Senator Von Imhoff had a question.
Thank you. So one of the questions is, do you have a way to monitor, or is it an issue when you have, I guess, foreign vessels that come into the either the Aleutians or Bristol Bay right at the 199-mile mark? and start fishing. I don't, does that happen? Is how do you handle that?
Yeah. Through the chair. Senator, yes, we have a robust enforcement process that we undertake, particularly with the U.S. Coast Guard, and we have a monitoring system that we've set up in order to ensure that we don't have vessels encroaching into our domestic waters. We don't have any vessels that are authorized to fish, foreign vessels that are authorized to fish in U.S. waters. So if a vessel were to cross over into our EEZ, Exclusive Economic Zone, that'd be a violation of laws, and that can be prosecuted. We have had cases of that. It's relatively rare, but it's something that we certainly keep an eye on.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
That just sparks I'm just curious, in any given year, how many foreign vessels are hovering within, 100 miles of that 200-mile mark?
Madam Chair, Senator, it is probably difficult to know within 100 nautical miles because it's such a vast amount of ocean. But we do have joint enforcement agreements with Russia. We have joint enforcement agreements with Korea and Japan and other nations that are bordering our waters in the North Pacific. For the most part, there are some vessels, including our vessels, that will fish close to the line because that happens to be where the stock is. Now, they are fishing off of their allocations that are provided on through their domestic management bodies. I think that that's something that's probably difficult for me to give you a precise number on. But we do try and track or better understand whether or not there are vessels that are increasing in the amount of activities that they have within high seas that are near Alaska's waters. Right now, we haven't necessarily seen a high degree of interest in some of the species that we're concerned about, but it is something that we obviously monitor, and I can provide you more detailed information after I check with the Coast Guard and other enforcement agencies.
Follow-up, Senator Hughes?
So you're not willing to give us a ballpark, and you could close it in. You could say 10 miles from the...
Right.
But I just have no idea. Can you give us just a ballpark range?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, I think it's probably, a handful of vessels that are fishing really close to the line. I'm thinking primarily between the U.S. and the Russia and the maritime boundary there for pollock. But that will vary from year to year. Because they're fishing there, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're encroaching into U.S. waters. It could simply be that that happens to be where the stocks are. And sometimes our vessels get close to the line as well. So,
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned you monitor this. How do you monitor it? By satellite? By drones? By boats? And what jurisdiction do you have if somebody is in our area that shouldn't be?
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have, so there's a variety of different tools that we can use. We can use satellite, we can use overflights. We have an overflight program with the U.S. Coast Guard where they go out and monitor those specific areas. They have cutter presence as well in these areas. We will get reports from the fleet if they see vessels that are near the maritime boundary, and we can use other tools. There's a AIS system that some vessels do use. It's not a requirement, but some vessels do have that, and that's another way that we can track them as well.
And
follow up?
If I may, Madam Chair, and what jurisdiction do you have? I mean, can you actually find them or
so we
seize
have,
their stock? Or?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, sorry to interrupt. We do have a variety of different enforcement tools. We have the domestic laws themselves, where if a vessel does encroach into U.S. waters, then there could be violations of the Lacey Act, there could be violations of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, there can be a variety of different laws that we can bring to bear, federal laws we can bring to bear. On the high seas, a number of these countries are also members of various what we call regional fishery management organizations, and these are organizations where they have agreed to certain provisions and restrictions on the use of their vessels, say, in high seas. If we have an issue with a vessel in those cases, then we can bring that case to the domestic body, and they can address it that way. We've had some success with a number of vessels being either scrapped or removed from service for various infractions that have occurred over the years. So there's that agreement that we have on an international basis as well. And then some of the domestic agencies as well have joint enforcement agreements with us. In other words, we will inform them if we witness any vessel behaving in a way that would be inconsistent with their domestic laws or our domestic laws, if that vessel were to transit back into their waters, we can pursue that through these joint agreements.
Thank you.
Very good. I'll let you continue.
Sure.
Just one issue I wanted to highlight a little bit, and it's a timely one, is that the the Council and NOAA are always looking at ways that we could innovate our management. And I think one issue I just wanted to briefly highlight here is that we have, as I mentioned earlier, a very robust observer program. Well, as you might imagine, for some small vessels, that is a concern of theirs. And one of the things that we have been responsive to at the council level and then as well at the federal level is trying to find better ways that we can gather at sea information that is perhaps less onerous or less difficult than having observers on board vessels. And this is particularly a concern for some of the small boat hook and line fleets. And what we've done is we've developed over the years a series of arrangements with the fleet to have volunteers take cameras on board their vessels to see whether or not we could use some sort of video system to be able to detect the specific species that are being discarded at sea and then measure those so that we can use that information in our day-to-day management. We just published yesterday a proposed rule that will look at ways to enshrine this in regulations that we hope to have in place for next year as a way to provide an opportunity for some of these small boats to take a camera instead of taking a human on board. And it's that kind of innovation, I think, that has allowed Alaska to be at the forefront of some of our management by continuing to look at ways that we can work with the stakeholders, engage them in finding solutions to problems that they have, and yet at the same time recognize the importance of getting good data for our management. And then just briefly, Madam Chair, I just wanted to highlight a few of the places you can go for additional information and contacts on the variety of groups that are involved. I mentioned, obviously, this NOAA Fisheries, myself, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, Mr. Hartzell at the State of Alaska, and then also the International Pacific Halibut Commission. I didn't touch on halibut here, but that is managed through an international treaty that we have with Canada, and we have a collaborative working relationship with them as well.
Very good. Any questions for further questions for Mr. Merrill? Thank you very much. Very, very helpful presentation. So once this wonderful asset is caught, our seafood, how do we market it? How do we get it to market? So I'm inviting Ms. Alexa Tonkovich to the table. She's from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And so she's going to share with us just exactly how organizations such as ASME add the necessary value. Mr. Andy Wink is online. He's an economist from McDowell Group, and he will follow Ms. Tonkovich. Welcome.
Thank you. Alexa Tonkovich, Executive Director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today. I've been asked to give a brief overview of how ASME brands the Alaska seafood commodity. I'll talk a little bit about the Alaska seafood brand in the diverse marketplace, a few global factors impacting the value of the seafood, and then I've been asked to discuss sustainability, eco-labels and marketing, and Alaska's responsible fisheries management from a marketing perspective. ASME is a public-private partnership between the Alaska seafood industry and the state of Alaska. We promote all commercially harvested seafood from the state, and we are the official promotional arm for the state of Alaska. If you look at ASME's current year budget breakdown, this perfectly demonstrates that we are truly a public-private partnership, and that ASME is a good example of how industry, state, and federal governments collaborate to promote a U.S. product. ASME is currently receiving money from the State of Alaska General Funds, from the Alaska seafood industry through a voluntary assessment which is paid by processors through the State Department of Revenue. ASME also receives federal funding through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Market Access Program. This is a federal grant which ASME competes for annually, and the funding goes towards promotion of U.S. agricultural commodities in international markets. There are many groups that are similar to ASME that are tasked with the promotion of commodities and the management of brands. ASME is part of a network of commodity boards and industry associations who also compete for this USDA grant funding and who also promote U.S. goods overseas. Some are public-private partnerships with their state, like ASME. Others are primarily industry-driven. We all share the goal of raising the economic value of our goods and to promote our state, country, and commodity brand. When we're able to collaborate with these commodity groups and combine resources, we do so. Okay, this didn't show up quite right, but that's okay. ASME is the brand manager for Alaska Seafood, and we aim to promote that brand in the United States as well as 27 countries internationally. While we strive to have some consistency in our brand, the same messaging, attributes, and aesthetic does not work in every market. Through market research, in-country expertise, and close alignment with our partners, we strive to find a message and a promotional vehicle to suit each market and market segment. We use a number of different platforms, e-commerce, in-store retail promotions, consumer advertising, social media. As you can see from this slide, the look and feel of an Alaska seafood promotion can be very different depending on where in the world you're shopping. ASME uses many traditional means to promote the Alaska seafood brand, things like print advertising and in-store promotions. But thanks to the digital age that we live in, there are new, exciting, and often less expensive ways to reach millions of consumers with our messaging. I mentioned in the previous slide e-commerce, which is quickly becoming the new way that consumers shop for groceries, particularly in Asia, but also in parts of Europe and in the U.S. Social media has really changed the marketing landscape as well. Alaska Wild Salmon Day, which is shown here, is a good example of this. We had the first ever Alaska Wild Salmon Day last August, and ASME engaged in almost exclusively online promotional activities. We didn't hold an in-person event, and we didn't pay for any advertising. We used public relations and primarily digital promotions, such as Snapchat and highlighting the event on our social media. This was a lower-cost effort than traditional promotion, and we were still able to generate 94 million consumer impressions. ASME works with a number of different partners to promote the Alaska brand. The above slide shows just a sampling of our U.S. food service partners with whom we work to make Alaska seafood a branded menu item across a broad range of establishments. We customize our promotional efforts to build on the strong brand equity of these partners and to leverage their budgets in addition to ours, as well as their customer base and their media channels. ASME and the Alaska industry have spent years building the Alaska brand, and the strength of the brand, particularly in the U.S., is really apparent. In 2015, for the first time ever, Alaska seafood became the number one brand among proteins on U.S. menus. This is the first time we've ever managed to beat Angus beef. Each year, ASME conducts consumer research in most of our major markets. From our latest U.S. research, we found that 94% of consumers are more likely to order seafood in restaurants when the word Alaska is used. These numbers aren't quite as high in international markets where we have fierce competition and have a less familiar origin to consumers. Our primary focus is to build the Alaska brand to add value. However, there are many things outside of our control that impact the value of the seafood resource. The strong U.S. dollar makes our products more expensive compared to competitors in overseas markets. It also makes the U.S. market a desirable market for imported seafood. As I mentioned, we face fierce competition from farmed and imported seafood, as well as other protein sources, compared to our wild harvest, which, as we know, is unpredictable. Things like the Russian embargo enacted in 2014 closed off our largest roe market and diverted farmed salmon into our major markets in Europe and the U.S. So switching gears to sustainability and marketing. Sustainability has long been a part of the Alaska brand. It's in our tagline, wild, natural, sustainable. However, the ways in which we've messaged around this topic have changed in the last decade and a half. Around the year 2000, the failure of the EU common fisheries policy led to a collapse in EU fisheries stocks, 80% of which were overfished. This prompted a fisheries sustainability movement and the heightened role of non-governmental organizations or NGOs in sustainability. Wild capture fisheries, like Alaska seafood, have been on the forefront of these sustainability measures and are decades ahead of other fisheries and other commodity groups. The fisheries sustainability movement led to the formation of the Marine Stewardship Council, or the MSC, which is backed by the World Wildlife Foundation. The MSC was formed to bring market pressure on companies to support sustainability. MSC needed a fishery to showcase this movement, and Alaska salmon was the natural choice. We in Alaska saw competitive advantage to marketing our sustainability, And so the Alaska Department of Fish and Game signed on with the MSC to certify the Alaska salmon fishery. As I mentioned, prior to MSC certification, we were already marketing sustainability, particularly in places like the UK, the US, and Germany. After receiving MSC certification, we began to use certification language in our marketing efforts. We were able to capture some additional promotional efforts through MSC-themed activities, and other Alaska species followed suit in gaining this certification. As MSC grew, however, globally, we began to see MSC replace Alaska on packaging and in stores and in advertising. We did feel some erosion of the Alaska brand, as, for example, our salmon would now be MSC salmon instead of Alaska salmon. As MSC expanded to include fisheries that are making progress toward but not fully sustainable, Alaska fisheries were then grouped in with that broader group. However, MSC has taken hold, particularly in Europe, and they're aggressively expanding to other markets. And despite Alaska's track record on sustainability, certification is a requirement in most major markets. Most customers are demanding third-party verification of sustainability. Given this, and given that certification is increasingly necessary for market access, our industry and our customers expressed the need to have a choice in certification programs, and ASME developed the Alaska Responsible Fisheries Management Certification, or RFM, the logo seen up on your slide. RFM is an independent third-party certification of Alaska's seafood sustainability. Alaska salmon, halibut, black cod, pollock cod, and crab are all certified by this standard, which is owned by the ASME board. RFM is based on the FAO code and guidelines, which is the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. Fisheries management and certification, which is the focus of the RFM program, are only two aspects of sustainability, which is an evolving topic. Alaska does very well with its fisheries management, thanks to the state and federal regulatory agencies that are in this room with me. Certification is available to major Alaska fisheries, both through the RFM and the MSC. Another part of sustainability is full utilization. ASME supports industry efforts through our technical program and through supportive programs initiated by groups like the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. Social responsibility is the coming trend in sustainability. Again, we have strong regulatory agencies in the U.S. and in the state which manage this, and it's not a part of the Alaska RFM program. We don't yet fully know how these trends will impact Alaska. More broadly, to many of us, sustainability is about fishing families and communities. Our fisheries are well managed so that the resource will be available for next generations and so that the Alaska industry will continue to support our communities. This is an important part of the Alaska story and a key part of our brand. Choice in certification isn't just important to Alaska. We've seen other FAO-based programs gain momentum worldwide. Iceland and Louisiana have similar programs to Alaska that are fully operational. Australia and New Zealand are conducting feasibility studies, and Canada and Japan have expressed interest in forming similar FAO-based programs. We are very proud of Alaska's Responsible Fisheries Management Program, as it is the first certification to successfully benchmark against a globally developed benchmarking standard through GSSI. GSSI is the Global Sustainable Seafood Initiative, and it's a platform to streamline sustainable seafood sourcing worldwide. Major companies have signed on that they will accept certifications that are benchmarked by GSSI. In fact, 2 weeks ago, Walmart announced they've changed their sourcing policies to include GSSI certifications. As I mentioned earlier, issues of social responsibility and ethical harvesting practices are the coming waves in the sustainability movement. This is in part due to recent headlines of poor labor practices in other fisheries. Many of our major customers are beginning to feel at risk and are requesting more formal assessments. This will be an additional demand placed on our industry to demonstrate their responsible practices. Again, as I mentioned, this is outside the realm of Alaska's RFM program, and ASME will look to industry as we craft messaging on these topics. That's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tonkovich. Question, Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. At what point does the RFM certification take place? Is when the commercial fisherman is selling his fish to the processor, or how does it work?
Through the chair, Senator, the RFM program certifies major Alaska fisheries, so the fishery itself is certified, and so anyone selling seafood can say that it's, you know, a sustainable, certified sustainable seafood. There is a mechanism through which people can get chain of custody, so they can have an audit of the fish from the moment it's caught to, you know, the moment it's processed in wherever to the moment it's sold in the grocery store. And that's a different process, but anyone has access to that.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Tonkovich? Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
What's the additional cost to your organization to do this?
Through the chair, just to clarify, Senator Von Imhoff, for the RFM program?
It says yes. So how does where does the money come from to do this?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the RFM program is managed by ASME. It runs approximately $1 million a year.
Follow up? Any further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Tonkovich. Next, we'll be going to Andy Wink. He is with the McDowell Group, and he will be talking about some economics related to our fisheries. Mr. Wink, welcome.
Yes. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right, great. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee today. For the record, my name is Andy Wink. I'm a seafood economist for McDowell Group. McDowell Group is a research-based consulting firm with offices in Anchorage and Juneau. Before I get into the slides, I want to give just a quick background about the company that I work for and its connection to the seafood industry. McDowell Group has been a research contractor for ASME since 1998. We track market conditions, inform industry and buyers about key trends, assist with ASME's federal grant application for MAP funds, and support all of their ASME's various programs with data and strategic consulting services. So beyond our work with ASME, McDowell Group has a long history of studying economic impacts in the seafood industry. Also analyzing market conditions and working on economic development projects for dozens of clients throughout the state. So in addition to seafood, our company also provides similar research services for oil and gas, mining, visitor industry, healthcare, Alaska Native organizations, the maritime support sector, as well as government agencies. So going into slide two, I think Alexa's going to advance my slides here if she'd be so kind.
She's ready.
I was asked to give an assessment of the Alaska seafood industry with kind of an emphasis on coastal and rural impacts, but it's really important to understand where the value and the volume comes from. So these pie charts here take into account all of our commercial seafood harvest and its ex-vessel value. Now, the ex-vessel value is the value of the fish as it goes from the fisherman to the processor. So you'll see that term used quite a lot in my presentation. And it's just important to kind of know what that is. And there are some fisheries in Alaska where you might have catcher processors where the fish is processed on the same boat it was caught. In those situations, they use an imputed ex-vessel price. So we're still talking about that kind of ex-vessel level of value. And going over to the harvest volume, you can see that most of our harvest volume is dominated by pollock, cod, and A80 is Amendment 80 species, which includes Aka mackerel, sole and flounder, and rockfish. Those three pieces of pie are about 81% of our volume, and they're primarily federally managed fisheries. But if you go over to the value, they're much, much smaller pieces, about 42% between the three pies there. I think the way to look at this is, yes, we catch a lot of high-volume ground fish, but when you look at the value, we have a very diverse portfolio of species, and frankly, a lot of states would count themselves lucky to have just one of these pie slices. Alaska, Mr. View, if the committee is aware, but Alaska accounts for 62% of U.S. harvest volume. So it's a tremendous resource, and really just nowhere else in the U.S. Even comes close to producing the volume that is here in Alaska. The other thing is that, you know, you can see the halibut, black cod, and crab there, less than 3% of overall volume, but almost, actually over a quarter of accessible value. So again, it doesn't have to, you know, species doesn't have to provide great volume to provide, important value. Let's go to the next slide. So once we've caught those fish and crab, what do we turn them into? And this slide shows you our production by product type. It's averaged over 2013 and 2014 because some years things can shift depending on the species that are caught. But this is a pretty good representation. And basically what it says is Alaska mostly produces primary and intermediate products. So most of our production is going to be sold to secondary processors or distributors. And those buyers also buy species from other fishery producers and from other aquaculture companies. So, you know, we're definitely competing in a global marketplace. And, you know, it's also worth noting, I don't have a slide on it. We have showed this slide before. But, you know, a lot of Alaska production has exposure to export markets. About two-thirds of Alaska's seafood value comes from foreign markets. And, you know, really all these categories have some components of them in that. You see the fillets there. I mean, I think a lot of times in Alaska seafood, we think about salmon, but actually the fillets are most of that value comes from pollock. Most of our H&G value comes from salmon, halibut, black cod, as well as Pacific cod. So that's kind of our production overview. Let's go to the next slide. So this breaks down it's mistitled, but it breaks down the value by residency. And so what we're looking at is the gross accessible value by Alaska residents versus non-residents. And non-residents out-earn Alaska residents overall, but it's kind of different depending on which species you're talking about, you know. And in the federally managed fisheries, the high-volume groundfish, that tends to be more non-resident, whereas salmon, halibut, and black cod, those tend to be have higher percentages of resident earnings in them. So when you think about kind of the Alaska fleet and the species that matter to it and what drives the value for that fleet, that's the pie chart on the right. And you can see that salmon is almost half of the Alaska resident fleet as value. Let's go to the next one. So this is a really important slide. It shows the value over time. And this is our accessible value, inflation adjusted in billions of dollars. And the gold line there is the U.S. dollar index. So back in the early 2000s, we had a real value crisis. Many people will probably remember, you know, some companies going out of business. A lot of fishermen went out of business, especially in salmon. Things were very, very tough. And a lot of that was driven by the strong U.S. dollar at the time. We also had the misfortune to have relatively poor salmon runs in 2002 and 2003. But, you know, that salmon crisis led to a lot of investment and a lot of innovation. And I think the entire industry really just, you know, it got so much better, and the products out there improved, the efficiency improved. So many things really were done a lot better after that. And, you know, as a result, value went up. But we also had a really important tailwind during that time in a weakening dollar. And so you can see as the dollar weakened there from the early 2000s, through 2011, our value basically goes up. And frankly, it probably would have continued on the same trajectory, but 2010 and 2009, we had very low pollock harvest, so that was part of the reason for those two off years. But then since 2011, things have shifted, and our value in the fisheries has declined. But at the same time, that's partly being driven by the stronger dollar. Excuse me. And I put a little asterisk in there just to show where the dollar index is today. It's between 100 and 102 over the last few months. So, you know, in general, a weak dollar, low index is good for Alaska. Strong dollars is bad. It just means that it takes more foreign currencies for our buyers to buy our products when the dollar is strong. So I think another thing to point out is even though this chart says a lot, I think it actually understates the difference in market conditions between, you know, say 2001, 2002, and 2015. In the early 2000s, the Russian ruble was actually quite a bit stronger, this other slide here that I didn't have included. So the Russian ruble in 2015 is actually 49% weaker than it was in 2002. And that's extremely bad for Alaska because Russia catches a lot of the same species that we do. They've also seen larger harvests of pollock. Their pollock harvests are up 96% since 2002. Their harvests of chum, sockeye, and pink salmon are all up dramatically. We've also faced more competition from things like Atlantic cod. So between 2002 and 2015, Atlantic cod is up 44%. Farmed Atlantic salmon is up 119%. And at the same time, halibut and black cod, those two really high-value species, has had the harvest volume drop 56%. So, you know, even though the dollar index was technically higher back in the early 2000s, I think there's a strong case to be made that market conditions now are even more difficult for Alaska seafood producers. Let's go to the next slide. So I wanted to provide a little bit of context because the strong dollar isn't just affecting Alaska seafood, it's also affecting its two other major natural resource industries, that being oil and gas and minerals. You can see here that, you know, we've had lower, I'll start at the top, I guess. Seafood, our volume's down 8% since 2011 through 2015. And we've had a first wholesale value change of 8% decline. And first wholesale value is basically when a product gets sold from the processor to a buyer. And that's sent our value from roughly $4.6 billion to $4.25. But, you know, as I said, the other industries have been greatly impacted, too, by a strong dollar and other factors. Oil down from 16.3 billion to 5.6, a 59% decrease. Minerals, mainly gold and zinc, down from 3.5 to 2.6. So I think that's kind of good context, and seafood certainly is the only one that's being kind of hit by this currency truck. Let's go to the next slide, and just kind of taking a little bit more of a look at what's changed in terms of species, because each year our total value is going to be driven by what we catch and what it's worth. And there are important changes over time in our harvest volumes of different species. And so, you know, I think kind of what this table, there's a lot of numbers going on here, and I apologize for that, but the main ones to pick out are probably salmon and halibut and black cod. Those two categories together are about a $300 million loss. And basically, we've just got less halibut and black cod than we did in 2011. Had slightly higher prices, but not enough to make up for lower volume. And salmon, we actually had a larger harvest in 2015, but prices really just collapsed, partly due to the large supply, the large harvest, but also primarily due to the strong dollar and just the fact that some of the species had it was hard to find competitive buyers that year for a number of reasons. But, you know, in the end, at the bottom there, you see this is our ex-vessel value, and it fell 17% since the peak in 2011. That's certainly not good, but considering that the dollar index gained 27%, I think that puts it in the appropriate context. Let's go to the next slide. So we've kind of seen where the value has gone over the last 15 years or so. And, you know, the question is always, what's going to happen this year? You know, what's next? Where's this market and this industry going? I think there's good reason to believe that we might see a value increase for the first time in a while this year. We're looking at a better salmon forecast. Pinks are way up. They had a historically poor run last year. Sockeye, our forecast is down somewhat next year, but prices are kind of building and demand's growing for that. So we expect salmon values to rebound in 2017. Pollock, the harvest is expected to be down in the Gulf of Alaska, and so that'll probably drag the overall harvest down a bit. It's going to be kind of touch and go. I'd say there's more downside with pollock in terms of the value. We think it will probably be flat depending on how the roe harvest and roe markets go. Last year was a really poor roe yield for pollock. They caught a lot of pollock, but they just didn't, the roe yield wasn't there, and so that led to a lower value. Halibut and black cod quotas are up a little bit, not, you know, anywhere near where they were historically, but trending in the right direction. Strong prices, so we expect value to be up for that. Cod and flatfish, both seeing better pricing, both slightly lower tax. And one thing about, you know, we're expecting less harvest from pollock, cod, and flatfish. Actually, the biomass and the biological health of these species in the Bering Sea is doing very well. But, you know, the acceptable biological catch in the Bering Sea for all ground fish is over 4 million metric tons. However, there's a hard cap in the Bering Sea of 2 million metric tons. So, you know, no matter what the biomass is there and how much we think we can acceptably catch, there's just a historical rule that we're not going to cross that 2 million metric ton threshold for ground fish in the Bering Sea.
Mr. Wink?
However, you know, I'm sorry, is there a question?
Mr. Wink, this is Senator Giesel. We have two other speakers after you, so if you could expedite somewhat your presentation.
I certainly can. I apologize for the delay. Well, why don't we go quickly through the next couple. This is just a table of the fishing and processing workers. You can see that we're down a little bit overall. And again, just looking at differences between 2011, our peak, and 2015, our last year with mostly complete data. The next slide, let's go to slide 10, Alexa. Similar things. This is for Alaska. You can see it by Alaska resident versus non-resident. And really what this is saying is that we're seeing more, a bigger impact on residents, right, in terms of their employment and their earnings, their gross earnings. Let's go to the next slide because I've got a few takeaways. Slide 11. So basically, declining excess of value has had a larger impact on the resident fleet, both in terms of employment and gross earnings. This resident fleet has more exposure to salmon and generally includes smaller, less efficient boats. Part of the way the figures look also is just depends on which fishery kind of gets hit from year to year and suffers poor harvest at the wrong time. Let's go to the next slide, slide 12. So this is the excess level value by Alaska region, you know, by region of residency. So you can kind of see where the fishing dollars go to our resident fleet. South Central is the largest, followed by Southeast, then Kodiak. And even though those three are the largest in terms of the piece of the pie, it's, you know, the impact and the money that goes to Western Alaska and Kodiak as well is actually proportionally larger, you know, than South Central and Southeast with the lower populations there. It's obviously huge, as Commissioner Laddick stated, it's a huge part of the economy out in Western Alaska, and just wanted to make that point, given that you know, the pies for South Central and Southeast are so much larger. Let's go to the next slide. So in terms of asking about how this industry has impacted coastal and rural areas and what the impacts have been, you can kind of see the change in permit holders as well as active skippers, and that those last two categories actually stands for non-ground fish accessible value. To compare the numbers the way we wanted to here, it just worked better to use that collection of species. And, you know, basically we've seen less participation, less employment, but the gross earnings, the fishing revenue really took a hit from 2011 to 2016 and 2015. So let's go to the next slide, slide 14. So as a result of lower employment, lower revenues, that's going to result in less residual economic impacts due to spending and taxes. As you saw from that chart on value, historical value, we grew for a long time. And during that time, permit values came up, boat values came up, quotas came up, the price of quotas. So a lot of things got more expensive in the fisheries, and then things started to come off. And, you know, in some cases, prices have come down, but in most cases they really haven't. So fishermen, you know, have less revenue, but they've still got big bills. And the lower values have also resulted in a balance sheet hit. You know, salmon permit values is something that we can track, and we saw the total value of Alaska salmon fishing permits fall 21% in 2016. As a loss of $175 million, basically off of the balance sheets of commercial fishermen. And Alaska residents, you know, bore the brunt of that, over $100 million. So basically, you know, we're seeing contraction, less value in both 2015 and 2016, and we had a significantly lower harvest volume in 2016. Just want to finish up with some points about kind of what's going on with the current market trends and issues. Let's go to slide 15. Currently, there's very low prices for Alaska pollock fillets. Fillets is usually the largest product for pollock, and the industry has been competing fiercely with Russian product, which is typically sent to China and processed and then resold as a twice-frozen product. And we're seeing encouraging things in terms of marketing once frozen versus twice frozen due to the superior quality. Hopefully that can continue because that's been a very beleaguered product, and it's one of our biggest. We've had low salmon prices for a few years, but that, and in addition to the work of ASME, has really been important in building demand for salmon and cod, specifically sockeye and cod. There's been tremendous in-store demonstrations and promotions done throughout the U.S., and we hear anecdotally in trade press that those are really making a difference, where we're seeing more demand in the U.S. market. Crab prices are at record levels, got low tax, but, you know, some mixed result of good fishing, you know, where we thought maybe we were going to have lower stocks, but fishermen are still finding the crab. We've got strong prices and better halibut and black cod quotas, so that's a plus. As I said, retailers just overall are finding that consumer demand, what their consumers want, is fitting more and more each year with what Alaska's seafood attributes are. So I think that's really encouraging going forward. On the flip side of that is, you know, Russia still has a very favorable currency situation. It makes their cost of production just much lower than ours, even than it was before. There are companies over there that can really turn out high quality salmon, pollock, and crab. And, you know, we have to figure out a way to beat them in the marketplace, going forward. And in some cases that will be difficult. And then pollock roe is another kind of beleaguered pollock product where we've just had supply growing faster than demand for years, and it's resulted in very low prices. And, you know, historically, pollock fishery really depended on roe because it was a high margin product and brought in, you know, paid a lot of the bills. And that's just not so much the case anymore. So these are kind of the big things that the industry is facing. And sorry for going over my time. I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wink. We appreciate your presentation. Great information. We'll go on now to some industry presentations. Nicole Kimball with the Pacific Seafood Processors Association is here.
Thank
Welcome,
you.
Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thanks for taking the time today and squeezing us in here. So I work for the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. My name is Nicole Kimball.
Perfect.
And
thank you.
I work in Anchorage. If you're not familiar with PSPA, this is a map showing all of the different communities in which these shoreside processing plants are located. This is a group of 9 companies. Like other trade associations for other resource industries, a group of people that came together over 100 years ago for this association and decided that there were enough statewide and federal issues that they could collaborate on and had interest in that they could work together on some of those issues. So that's what PSPA does, in addition to just trying to foster a better understanding of the seafood industry and its importance to Alaska. So these member companies, you can see there's 9 there. They're located in all these communities. It's about 31 different shoreside plants. And then there are 2 companies that have floating processor vessels that only buy seafood and process it on shore. They don't catch seafood. So these companies purchase, process, market, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds of pollock, cod, halibut, sablefish, all of the fisheries in which you've been given a presentation on here today. They're dependent on state water fisheries. They're dependent on federal fisheries, large boats, small boats. The whole gamut is what these processors buy. So these were the issues I was asked to cover. I will really try to not repeat what we've heard. We've gotten a lot of on marketing and on sustainable management through previous presentations, so I'll try to go pretty quickly. This is one slide on seafood value. You know, we're talking about $4.2 billion in first wholesale value for all the seafood off Alaska annually. We typically harvest between 5 and 6 billion pounds annually, and that's under very conservative management. I'll have a slide later to talk about that. And it's important because it generates almost $6 billion in economic activity in Alaska every year. And as you've heard already, domestic markets are very important, and they're very key when we have a strong dollar. But some of these export markets are very critical for some specific species. And Alaska, on the whole, makes up 55% of all U.S. seafood exports. This is just 2 examples of some of our big, important species. And I think it's clear from previous presentations that we're in a global market, and salmon is one of those same species. So if you look at the very tallest bar on the end, that's 2015. This is a slide I took from Gunnar Knapp. He uses it a lot. It shows that we're in a global salmon market, and it's dominated by farmed Atlantic salmon. So the red part of the bar on that tallest bar is all the farmed global supply of salmon, and then the whitish-gray bar at the bottom is all of the wild supply, and of course we're a component of that wild supply. So that shown here is about 28% of the global supply. And that means that we are price takers in this market. We do not have enough market share to really drive prices. So it means that we're linked to global price trends. So as aquaculture or farmed supply increases, we're linked to any price trends that they create. I think it's very important to understand this in part. I mean, we are a salmon state, and salmon creates the most economic activity in Alaska. So all fisheries in terms of jobs, in terms of income and total value among all species, as you saw from Andy Wink's presentation, it makes up 1/3 of the total wholesale value of all fish species off Alaska. So it's important to know where we fall in the global market. This is another good example, another situation, pollock, in which you have competing products, so whitefish products. Tilapia is one of those things. I always tell everybody, don't ever eat tilapia. You can see, kind of, those numbers are fading out, but that the global tilapia supply, it's about 5.8 million metric tons. So that greatly outweighs our total pollock supply of 3.5 million metric tons. even the growth in some of these farmed whitefish species markets outweighs the total pollock supply from wild sources. So that creates a big strain on harvesters and processors that are dependent on pollock. The market's depressed. It's in a terrible shape, and it's for all the reasons that you've heard from Andy and from Alexa. A lot of competition, a market increase in Russian production, a strong dollar, and a Russian embargo to the point that we can't export fish to Russia, but they can import fish into the United States. This is significant to Alaska because it is our highest volume fishery, as was said already. It's a fishery that has long seasons. It's a fishery that supports activity in a lot of different communities with processors from the Pribilof Islands, the Alaska Peninsula, Gulf of Alaska communities like Kodiak, King Cove, Sandpoint. That's not mentioning even Dutch Harbor that we've talked about. So this has the volume fishery to keep processing plants in some communities operating nearly year-round, and that's important for job growth. Like salmon, pollock makes up about one-third of the first wholesale value of all seafood off Alaska. So between pollock and salmon, we're talking two-thirds. So that's why I use these as examples. And I'd like to note that I saw the Alaska Department of Labor come out with their unemployment rate for February today, and they noted that, you know, we're at 6.4%, but across the state, unemployment fell in 10 different areas, and the regions with winter fisheries, which are these groundfish fisheries, had the lowest unemployment rates. This is really the core of what I was asked to talk about. I think like other markets, the key to seafood is control of supply. So buyers want to commit to those companies, those processing companies, that they trust to follow through with supply, and that they only want to invest in species that are reliably available. So generally, that kind of combination, volume and reliability, puts Alaska in a really unique position, despite all the market challenges that you've heard about today. But in these markets in which there are a lot of competition from species that have a controllable supply, like farm species, low cost of production, these are the ways in which we increase value in Alaska fish. So marketing, production, and management investments. And I'd like to point out, obviously, in the slide I show that everybody's putting more money at every step of the supply chain to increase value. Harvesters and processors clearly have sunk costs. You know, we had a terrible pink salmon run last year. Everybody still had to make their boat payment. Everybody had crew ready. We had people in processing plants. When those fish don't materialize, those are costs that are lost. Retailers and food service are a little bit different. They have sunk costs as well, but they're not tied to a specific species or a specific product. So if the product price changes too much or the supply is not reliable, they can walk away and move to something else. These are a couple of the marketing investments. You know, how does Alaska compete? We try to push out new product development to find new seafood products that major buyers are going to want to push out to their consumers. So creating new fish consumers is a major objective all the time. These are some of the domestic buyers that I have listed on here, and that's up there because the strong dollar is obviously putting more emphasis on our domestic markets. So that's why I've got those up there. The main message from this slide is because we don't have the marketing budget, any individual company, to move the whole needle on U.S. seafood demand, we need to leverage the marketing budgets of these major buyers to tell that story for us. So we need them to use their marketing budgets to say why Alaska seafood and Alaska wild seafood is the best product. And I've got a couple examples here. I don't know if we have time for that. One of these examples, if you can see, is that foot-long wild-caught Alaskan pollock. That's a new product from Subway, brand new. It's in 1,000 stores. That took 2 years of research and development by one of our processing company members. It's a Alaska pollock coated in sea salt, pepper breading. It's pre-cooked, which was part of the R&D, in order to meet the customer's food safety requirements. But what's interesting, this was put out for Lent, is the marketing around it. It's no longer a fish sandwich in most of these advertisements. It's wild-caught Alaska pollock. And they've recognized that pushing that Alaska brand is good for them. They sell more fish because that's important to consumers. If we have 15 seconds, I wanted to show you this. And if it doesn't work immediately, I will not do it.
This is Davis. He's from here. There's more, so don't click here. This is a McDonald's fillet of fish made with real wild-caught pollock from here. So we took Davis to fish with this guy at a certified sustainable fishery. Then he went here because all that adventure made Davis hungry.
Okay. try to close that out. So that's an example of a product that's been around for 50 years. That product hasn't changed, but the marketing around it really has changed. The fact that that happened is because a company in our group got McDonald's buyers to actually come out and go on these boats and experience the fishery. So now they're using the fishery participants, crew members in social media. They're using them in that advertisement. You can see they pointed to the Gulf of Alaska in the advertisement. You know, most of our pollock comes from the Bering Sea, but there's truth in advertising because when McDonald's came out, they went to the Gulf of Alaska. So it's important that we're trying to get other people to tell our story, and those are some really recent successes. Those are brand new. I will try to go quickly here. I was also asked to talk about some investments in operations and facilities. There are a lot of demands on the industry to keep up with current infrastructure. A lot of the infrastructure is aging at the same time. I'll use salmon as an example. In the past, I think you've heard there's a lot of investments in new technology, such as fillet and vacuum packing machines, moving more from the canned salmon world into fillets. That continues to happen. There's been a lot of investment in salmon oil extraction machinery, so ways to get all the oil that we can out of the fish, move into the nutritional supplement market, which is a really good market to be in. There's also been a lot of the kind of boring investments, like moving from traditional lighting to LED lighting to save money. Finding ways to self-power your facility in case the community can't handle that level of power generation. At present, and I think Mark will talk about this more, there's a significant emphasis, particularly in salmon and in Bristol Bay, on using refrigerated seawater systems, RSW tanks on fishing boats. So the impetus there is companies, seafood processing companies, are paying financial incentives to fishermen to meet certain quality standards. So the higher quality fish you bring in, which you can do if you have an RSW tank, to the processor, the higher quality product you can create and the more money you can get for that. So that's ways in which we're all working toward a good end. I think in the future, some things to emphasize, there's still possibility for new canning line technology. Automation will likely replace some functions in processing plants in part due to minimum wage increases, 26% over the past 2 years. That makes people look at where can we automate. There are also going to be continue to be major capital expenditures to expand the existing fresh and frozen markets. At the bottom of the slide, I mentioned a brand new facility in Kodiak. That didn't replace a processing plant or upgrade it. It built a whole new plant that's kind of unusual this day and age. That plant rounded out all the product forms that company could provide. It has state-of-the-art technology. It's highly computerized, but it offers some really great long-term, highly skilled positions for Kodiak residents. So we're very proud of that opportunity. Very, very quickly, because you've heard this is just a good visual. Alaska seafood has thrived because of its stability, and that's in part due to these management systems that you've heard about, both the state system, which is based on sustainable yield, the federal system is based on the same concepts that Ten Stevens put in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. This is a good visual, I think, for the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands. The blue bars there are the biomass. They do surveys every year for all of these commercial species. So you can see the biomass is over 21 million metric tons. The red bars there are the overfishing levels. Then you've got green and yellow, two different bars of catch limits. And then the purple is the harvest, the catch. So aside from the huge difference between the catch and the biomass, you've just got all these buffers laid in there to ensure that we're staying within the sustainable management system. And that's what sustained this level of harvest for generations. I don't need to go into detail because Alexa did a great job on sustainability, but I just want to emphasize this is another investment. I mean, this is something that seafood processors pay for, and it's expensive. But it's an absolute necessity in most markets. You need to have an independent party certify your product as sustainably sourced in order to sell it in most markets these days. So we need competition in that certification business. That's the impetus between the Responsible Fisheries Management Program that Alexa talked about, having more than just MSC out there as a certifier and having people, buyers, recognize that brand. So having it meet these global sustainability standards very recently is a big, big win for those in Alaska. I think the bottom bullet there, this is what I've been talking about lately more than anything, keeping Alaska Seafood as a premium brand, which is what we're all trying to do, and getting a higher value for that brand means not undermining any of the harvesting, processing, management systems that got us to the place that we are at now. And so part of that is this need. Sustainable management costs money. We want to try to fish near optimum yield to pay for it, and that means funding for biological data. So this is kind of the message I've been talking to various legislators about, that we need to ensure that we still have these WIRs, surveys, in-season management projects funded and in place. Because if we don't have those, then we result in more conservative management to account for that uncertainty, which means less fish across the docks, less income for Alaskans, less tax revenue for the state, and less revenue sharing for coastal communities. So on both the federal and the state level, we're always a strong advocate to keep those biological systems running. This is just very quickly what puts those investments at risk. I think you've heard a lot about that today, so I won't delve into that anymore. And then to transition into Mark's presentation, these are a few of the state-specific issues, I think, that can serve to reduce risk, add stability, help us compete in this difficult climate. I know he's going to talk more specifically about actions that the legislature has taken to date that have helped sustain the fishing industry in Alaska and what we can look forward potentially in the future. So I tried to go quickly. I hope it wasn't too quickly, but I really appreciate your attention.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kimball. So next we will go to Mark Vinson, United Fishermen of Alaska. So welcome, Mr. Vinson.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Vinsel, and I am Executive Administrator at United Fishermen of Alaska. And for yourself and the committee members, we were asked to briefly touch about on industry marketing initiatives, technology and modernization, and sustainable management. United Fishermen of Alaska is an umbrella association. We've only been going for about 42 years, but we have 34 member groups right now, pretty much spanning the fisheries throughout the state and offshore federal waters. Marketing initiatives from the fishermen sector, everything relates back to ASME and, of course, to processors. But there's three trends I wanted to sort of just touch on. One is direct marketing, fishermen selling their own fish. Another is regional marketing, and then community-supported fisheries. Direct marketing, four ways come to the top of my head. One is just selling right off the dock here in Juneau, off your boat. Then there's local retail and restaurants. And then the bigger, broader market of reaching out, shipping outside of Alaska to U.S. consumers and then U.S. restaurant and caterers. Depending on which of these target you're going to do, your business would be different. It's definitely different than just being a fisherman that delivers to processors. That's a much simpler thing for business, for a fisherman to do. SB 286 from 2004, I really appreciated Andy Wink's slide that showed how bad things were in the salmon industry. We had a lot of fish, but the price wasn't paying for people to go out and fish. So that was the crisis. Legislature formed the Joint Legislative Salmon Industry Task Force. And there were about 13 bills came out of that task force, but over the next 3 or 5 years, there was a total of about 50 bills that came out from ideas and concepts with that. SB 286 in 2004 streamlined the paperwork and tax burden for direct marketers, and so we saw a rise of that. The opportunity for direct marketers is really varies by your local community. If you don't have a local market to sell to, then you can't sell locally. If you don't have the infrastructure, maybe electricity costs, transportation, and even sort of a critical mass of other support services, it's available to some people in some communities, but definitely not to all of Alaska fishermen in all communities. Regional marketing was also spawned by the legislature coming out of the Joint Legislative Salmon Industry Task Force. There was HB 419. And that allowed a voluntary assessment where fishermen in a given fishery in a region can vote. If more than half of them vote to do this, they will tax themselves 1% on their catch, and that will go to a local entity, a regional marketing association that then can invest as that local fishery sees fit for what they need to market or develop their fisheries. Right now we have Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association and then Copper River Prince William Sound Marketing Association. There have been a few others that have where an the impetus started, but it was not approved by the fishermen. But these two have funded. Bristol Bay has a whole bunch of ice. They really identified the quality of their fish coming to the processors was a problem. And Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association has provided ice barges, equipment, moving of ice, moving of fish, and then as well as Copper River doing a lot of branding, promotions, research, R&D on nutrition, contaminants, some product development. But these have really allowed fishermen to go above and beyond in coordination with ASME, but with a local marketing. ASME will only market for the whole big picture of Alaska seafood. Next, we have community-supported fisheries. I was a little pleased. I knew of two, and I was one of the first subscribers here in Juneau for Alaska's Own, which came from Sitka and sells fish in Sitka and Juneau. You pay ahead on a subscription basis. This sort of cuts a little bit of the risk for the price fluctuations that fishermen are subject to at the docks. I don't know if you're familiar with some organic farmers that do this in the lower 48. The first one in fisheries was in Maine in 2007, and I met the gal and introduced her to a few people in Alaska, and we've gone forward. Just in looking this up, I found three or four more that I wasn't aware of. But pretty notably, the Alaska Marine Conservation Council has spawned one that now services Anchorage, Matsu, Homer, Seward, and Fairbanks. I think that's a great way for people to, it gives customers confidence in the chain of custody. They're supporting their local community, and their fishermen are basically keeping local. It really directly connects fishermen to their markets. All of these really rely on ASME for materials, their promotions, their brochures, this online seafood directory, chef collaboratives. There are many different ways that ASME helps connect these direct marketers to either their restaurants in the lower 48 or whatever. But by being aware of and making use of ASME's materials, they have a big head start in their job of reaching the market and providing materials, recipes, and things like that. Fishermen also directly interact with ASME. There's three seats on the ASME board that are fishermen seats, and then there's a committee system where individual fishermen for different fisheries engage in ASME and their planning on those fisheries. Next, technology and modernization. Again, going back to the tough times in salmon, chilling, freezing on board. That's been a big trend. Many processors won't take fish unless they're chilled, either with ice or refrigerated salt water, and that's a lot different than it was in 2000. But by having that quality fish brought in the best shape it could be in, we have an opportunity in the market competing against farm fish, which starts with a live fish. Other things going on in technology and modernization, a lot of fuel efficiency measures. There are specific things that people can do. It all costs money. There's also there was a McDowell report that came out last fall with a vessel replacement. The study was on the North Pacific fleet, the large boat fleets offshore, and it estimated $1.6 billion would be spent in the next 5 to 10 years on rebuilding vessels and upgrades to that fleet. Now, this was for the Port of Seattle that commissioned this report. I think there are definitely Alaska opportunities out of that $1.6 billion. We have UFA members that built large vessels in Ketchikan. We have there's shipbuilding operations in Seward, Kodiak, and then a little bit smaller in Wrangell. But Wrangell made a lot of investment to allow a boat service sector in their community, and then spread more around the state. There are opportunities for improvements on small boat fleets. Other things going on in technology, navigation technology, there's vessel monitoring. I believe it was Glenn Merrill who mentioned the observer electronic monitoring. Instead of having an observer that you have to have on your boat and make room for them and feed them and all that, the cameras. There are also some data networks for how people fish, where people fish, to help them avoid if all of a sudden there's a high level of bycatch in a certain area. There are data networks of fishermen collaborating to move away from there so that they're not going to exceed a bycatch limit that may cause a hard shutdown to the fishery. All of these require investment. So both the Commercial Fishing Agriculture Bank established way before my time, and then the Division of Economic Development Loan Programs. Both of these have some touch to Alaska statute, and I know the Division of Economic Development Loan Programs in DCED have statutory requirements on their loans. So new programs are often come through the legislature for approval. I know they have energy fuel efficiency upgrades and some product quality improvements that have been spawned by the needs that we've all been discussing here. So those loan programs are very important to all aspects of the fisheries, and especially as they are one of the very, very few tools in the toolbox for Alaska to favor its own residents. We are a U.S. state, and we have to provide these opportunities in our commerce and resources for people from other states. But we can provide a leg up to our own residents with the Division of Economic Development Loan Programs. Sustainable management, we've heard a lot about it. It goes back to the Alaska Constitution. It's required. Then the nexus with Alaska history, the statehood vote was combined on an election day with banning of fish traps because I know Ernest Greening's history describes that they felt that that was probably important way to make sure that both of them went through and were passed by the voters. UFA has a policy for healthy and sustainable management of fisheries. We support state management of salmon fisheries, escapement goal management based on biological escapement goals, local management that is adaptive and abundance-based, and the use of commissioner's emergency order authority on an active basis for the local management. And that includes opening when there's a whole surplus of fish coming, or then sometimes closing with no notice, because if there aren't the fish there, we don't want to be harvesting them and cause future problems by over-harvesting. And we support mixed stock management. If there are opportunities to harvest a fish at a large that's in large numbers, we don't like to see that curtailed to protect a small fish, unless there's real sustainability problems with that fish. In practice, Nicole, a lot of people mentioned the cost and the importance of the biological information. Weirs, counts, management plans have thresholds. The Board of Fish process kind of creates these management plans and the council process for what we can foresee. And then if there's things that we can't foresee, that's where the emergency authority comes in to shut things down. The sustainability certifications do bring an additional cost. I call it the social license to operate, because when they started MSC, they came to us. We were sustainable. We were already there. And even in the 2007, 2010, sustainability became a very common word when people talk about food and industries. We were already there. They found us there, and we benefit from that still. But to have to pay somebody else to tell somebody that you're okay, again, that money has to come out of the fish. So where does that leave the person whose business is barely hanging on? But I have to hats off to the Marine Advisory Program. They help the Young Fishermen Summit and their Fish Big Biz project, helping especially the fishermen who aren't so seasoned in it, the difficulties of running a fishing business. Marine Advisory Program does a good job in helping with the next generation. And just to round it out, this is the bonus slide. I knew we would run out of time, but we feed the world. There was legislative involvement in as well as ASME in getting Alaska fish into global food aid programs. There's very little that I can think of that would be more beneficial to people that suffer from no protein in their local area than a shelf-stable can of pink salmon. It's superfood, and by getting into these USDA and global food aid programs, we help kind of move the fish, get people interested in it, and it helps the market conditions with the fish. And the ASME food aid program, I think, is worth noting here. And I just mostly, as going through all kinds of pictures for this, this is one of my favorite pictures we have in our whole lineup. With that, I'll answer any questions. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vinsel. That was great. All these presentations have been wonderful. You know, one of the important things that I always want to emphasize as chair of this committee is that Alaska's oil is not just hydrocarbons. There's also the oil that we see in fish, and that that being a protein source and omega-3s, which make for healthy people. As a nurse practitioner, I always recommend fish oil. So thank you very much for the presentation to everyone who presented today. This concludes our meeting today. Our next meeting will be Monday, March 27th. At that time, we're going to take up an appointment to the Board of Game, three appointments to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and Senator Machicki's Senate Bill 92. So at this time, we will adjourn. The time is 5:25 p.m.